When I was a kid, one of my chores was to wash the dishes after each meal, after we cooked, because in my house it was a clear rule that if you cooked, it meant you didn't clean. And on one of these instances, when I was doing dishes, it was, I don't know if we had just made cookies or what, but one of the baking trays was still hot, and so not wanting to touch it, I ran it under some cold water. And it warped, it got bent out of joint, and my mom saw me, and you could see the disappointment on her face, and she started to get mad at me until she realized I had no idea that that's what would happen. And she explained to me how when you have really something that's very hot, that suddenly becomes very cold, it can cause it to warp, it can cause it to break. I think she explained to me what Pyrex was and how you shouldn't do that with glass. And unfortunately, I didn't test that out. I definitely should have. That would have been a lot of fun. But she explained how when you have sudden transitions like that, it's jarring. And we can have sudden transitions like that in the life of following Jesus. He says that in this world, you'll have trouble, that following him makes things more harder. But in the same sentence, he says, "Take heart, for I have overcome the world." We have a lot of this jarring tension in the life of Jesus. And we have it in our church calendar too, where we go from Epiphany, which focuses on revealing the glory of Jesus and all of the light of who he is. And it goes from there straight into Lent, which is all about how we deny ourselves, how we get ready for the coming of Jesus at Easter. It seems like there's a big tension there. We have lots of paradox in following Jesus. And in order to get used to it, in order to walk in his steps without having our hearts get out of joint, we have to know what to do with this tension. And the transfiguration is a lens, is a window in to how we handle that. And it is appropriately so as a hinge between the glory of Epiphany and the lowliness of Lent. So hopefully as we look at the transfiguration, we can see how to keep our heart from getting put out of joint with these two ends of the Christian life. You can follow along with me in Mark 9. That's where our passage is. So our passage starts out by talking about how Jesus invited Peter, James, and John up the mountain with him. The other disciples were not there. It was just the three of them and Jesus. And this has happened before in the Gospel of Mark. In Mark chapter 5, these were the only people there who witnessed Jesus raise from the dead the daughter of a local ruler. And so we have, again, this elite company of the disciples who are with Jesus. That's not an unusual thing that we see in the Gospels. We'll see it again when Jesus is praying in the Garden of Gethsemane. But what is unusual is how he starts out this passage. You'll notice in verse 2 how it says, after 6 days, Jesus took with him. So if you read through the Gospel of Mark, oftentimes Mark is a man of few words. He's not one for transitions. Most of the time, his transitions are just along the lines of, and Jesus did this, or then Jesus went there. So we have an unusual instance here when Mark is giving us a clear transition that's tying it with what came before. And so as good readers, we are naturally asking ourselves, well, what happened 6 days ago? What came before this passage? And we can see that if you turn back to Mark 8:27, you see where Peter confesses that Jesus is the Christ. He says, Jesus, you are the one who has come to restore all things. You are the Messiah who's come to make the world right. Everything in Mark up to that point is focused on Jesus and his actions revealing that he is the Messiah. And after that point, it's focused on Jesus explaining to his disciples, showing them what kind of Messiah he is. And so right after Peter says, Jesus, you are the Christ, you are the Messiah, Jesus says, you're exactly right, and this is the kind of Messiah that I am. You see how in verse 31 he says that he's the kind of Messiah who must suffer, be rejected, and be killed. That is the kind of Messiah that he is. And Peter is like, this is kind of awkward, because that's not what I meant. And Jesus is like, well, this is kind of awkward because you're wrong. And he says that he calls Peter Satan, which is a really strong phrase, but he's saying that in that moment, it's not that Peter is Satan incarnate, but what he's saying is just in line with what Satan was trying to do. If you think back to the temptations of Jesus, what Satan is trying to get in the end are things that are rightfully Jesus's. He's trying to get Jesus to have the glory over all of the world, to be enthroned over all of the world. But he's trying to tempt Jesus to do that in a way that does not involve the cross. And so what Peter is saying here is in line with Satan's way, because he's saying, look, you can be the Messiah and not have to suffer. And so that's why Jesus rejects him so strongly and then goes on to show that he must suffer and die. And so that's what happened right before this passage. Right before this passage, Peter had been utterly opposed to the way of Jesus. And yet Jesus still invites Peter up onto the mountain. It didn't say that Jesus invited James and John, and Peter was going to come, but after what he said, he just missed the cut. He got Bartholomew instead. No, he brought Peter up, which is such a picture of grace, that even if you have been doing things that have been seemed so at odds with the way of Jesus, that does not mean that Jesus won't reveal himself to you. Even if it's just as few as 6 days ago, Jesus still invites you to behold his glory. And so Peter, James, and John go up on the mountain, and what do they see? They see Jesus transfigured. And this is where it can be easy for us to think, if the transfiguration is supposed to help us like go in between these two tensions, if it's supposed to help our heart, our soul, not get out of joint with these two extremes, I feel like this is not helping. I feel like I'm more lost as opposed to more grounded. But let's just see what's happening here. So in the transfiguration, it's not that Jesus has changed who he is, but to be transfigured means to like have your outward appearance change. And so what Peter and James and John are seeing is they're seeing Jesus in a new light, which is something that you probably have all experienced with someone in your own life. Not like this, but you probably have someone that you know that you saw them in a new context. Perhaps you saw them at their job. Perhaps you saw them in their elements. And all of a sudden, you're like, I didn't know that about that person at all. I'm seeing a whole new side of them. That happens to a humorous way in Parks and Rec, in the TV show. Ron Swanson is the caricature of gruff masculinity. He likes to eat meat a lot. He likes to be a woodworker. But no one knows that he moonlights in the next town over as a saxophone player who plays smooth jazz. And when the other characters find out about this, they're wowed, like, what? That's who he was this whole time? I had no idea. And that's what we're getting right here with Jesus. These disciples would have been with Jesus day in and day out. They would have seen him struggle with things. They would have seen him tired and hungry. They didn't shower a lot. They would have known what his BO smelled like. They would have been very familiar with the humanity of Jesus. And now what they get is a glimpse of how he's divine. They see a new side of him in a new way. And that's highlighted even more when we see how Moses and Elijah are there as well. So you don't have to be a Bible scholar to know that these are pretty big deals in the Old Testament, that Moses was like the founding father of sorts of the nation of Israel who led them out of slavery, that and Elijah was a big prophet who opposed kings and queens to call them back to the way of the law that God had revealed to his people. They both have powerful experiences of God on mountaintops. Moses, where he receives the Ten Commandments and later sees God's back, as it were. Elijah, as we read about this morning. And they both are so pivotal figures in the Old Testament that they're both tied with what the coming Messiah would be like or how that might work. In Deuteronomy, it says that that there would be raised up from the brothers of Israel another prophet like Moses. And the book of Deuteronomy ends saying that still had not happened yet. And then Elijah, it was said that Elijah would come again before the Messiah, that there would be a forebearer of Elijah before the Messiah came back. That's what we read at the beginning of Mark 1, where it's talking about his baptism. And so both of these are huge figures who kind of represent the law and the prophets. They point to Jesus, and here they are on this mountain with Jesus, and yet they don't hold a candle to how glorious Jesus is. Jesus is so evidently God. He's so evidently divine that these two amazing saints of the Old Testament are nothing compared to the amazing light that Jesus is shining. And so in the Transfiguration, we see one extreme of the Christian life. We see the glory. But in order to fully understand the Transfiguration, we have to take a cue from Elijah. Mother Susan talked about how Elijah had to listen to the still, small voice of God. And in the Transfiguration, we also have to listen to the voice of God to help understand what's going on, to help not get lost in between the glory and the suffering. And so what does that voice say? The voice says, "This is my beloved son. Listen to him." And if you are reading all the way through Mark in one sitting, you might have a eureka moment. You might say, wait a second, this sounds kind of familiar. And you'd be right, because earlier in the Gospel of Mark, in Mark chapter 1, when Jesus is baptized, there is a voice from the heavens over Jesus that comes down and speaks. Now at Mark's baptism, at Jesus' baptism, this is what the voice from heaven says. It says, "You are my beloved son. With you I am well pleased." Now listen carefully to that. "You are my beloved son. With you I am well pleased." And contrast it with what we have here. "This is my beloved son. Listen to him." In both instances, the voice is from heaven. In both instances, the voice is talking about who Jesus is. But at Jesus' baptism, the audience for the voice was Jesus himself. God the Father was talking to God the Son about who God the Son was. Here, the audience of the voice is the disciples. God the Father is talking about God the Son to his disciples. And he's telling them to listen to him. And that, again, causes us to wonder, well, listen to what? What about what Jesus is saying are we supposed to listen to? And we're reminded again of what happened just before this, when Jesus said that he was going to die. And Jesus said, if you are going to follow me, and if I'm the kind of Messiah who's going to die, you have to experience a death of some kind as well, also. You have to take up your cross and follow me. So that is what the Transfiguration, the voice there, is pointing us to. It's pointing us how the glory of Jesus is revealed not just here on the Mount of Transfiguration, but on the cross. That he's telling his disciples to not get lost in the glory, but to remember the cross as well. And this is a deep reminder that we need to not get lost in this tension. It's easy for us as Christians to want the life of Jesus to be from one glory to another, from victory to victory. Everything is going to be great. Everything is going to be easy. But that's not always how it works. And the Transfiguration reminds us of that. The Transfiguration reveals the glory of Christ, but it reveals at the same time the lowliness of Christ. It shows how the glory of Christ is most revealed not here in the Transfiguration, but at the cross. So I often joke that Anglican churches aren't creative. We do the same thing more or less each week. We're not creative with our names either. It seems like the vast majority of Anglican churches have the same kinds of names: Christ Church, Redeemer, Church of the Resurrection, Incarnation. Church of the Cross is also a common one. You know what's not a common name of Anglican churches? Church of the Transfiguration. This is like the most glorious moment we have in all of Jesus' life. And yet it's not one that we often memorialize in our church names. There are loads of churches of the cross. There aren't hardly any churches of the Transfiguration. In the early church, when they were trying to come up with a symbol of their movement, they didn't start drawing Jesus transfigured. They drew a cross. And I don't think it's because a T is easier to draw than whatever is happening here. I think it's because it's more central to the glory of Jesus. It's more central to what his ministry is all about. At one point in his ministry, Jesus says, "Now the Son of Man is glorified." But he says it right after Judas goes out to betray him. He says that he is most glorified in his passion and death. That is what the Transfiguration is all about, how the glories of Jesus help us better understand the lowliness of Jesus. The glories of the Mount of Transfiguration help us better understand the glory of the Mount of Calvary. That this same Jesus here would be the same Jesus that takes up his cross, and he invites us to do the same. That is how he is glorified. And so what can we do in response? How can we live in a way to not get caught in between these two extremes, not have our soul get warped out of joint? One thing that we can do is that when we see Jesus glorified like this, when we have moments of glory in our own lives where Jesus seems so near and so tangible and so real, we can stop and we can worship and appreciate that. That's one thing that we can do. But it's important also that we go down the mountain with Jesus. Peter says, "Hey, do you want us to make a tent? We can stay here forever. It would be great." But they have to go down the mountain. And as soon as they go down the mountain, they encounter struggle. The disciples fail to do something, and Jesus is exasperated. But we learn more about the glories of Christ, not just when we have those sweet moments, but when we're walking through the valleys and experience the nearness of Christ in a new way. In our own lives, our valleys manifest the glories of God in a way that our mountaintops never could. And so we see that in our own lives as well. It's also important for us to remember that if Jesus was this great, as we see him here on the Mount of Transfiguration, if this is how amazing he is, and yet he goes to die and takes up his cross, then we can do the very same thing. We all have things that we don't like to do We all have words of Jesus that we wish he hadn't said, that we want to apply to other people and not to us. But what Jesus reminds us here is that no one is exempt from taking up their cross. No one is exempt from following him. It doesn't matter how glorious you think you are not as glorious as Jesus is right here. And yet this same Jesus took up his cross for us. So how could we not do the same in response to what he has done for us? And it's going to be hard to keep these things in tension always, but that is what we are calling is as a Christian, is to see at the same time how Jesus' glory makes more stunning his suffering, and how his suffering magnifies his glory. That's what we see here in the Transfiguration. That's how we see these two things held together in a way that don't cause us to get put out of joint. So please pray with me now. Jesus, I thank you that you revealed yourself to us in all of your glory, that you showed us the heights of your wonder in the Transfiguration. But we thank you also that your glory on the cross is far greater. And so we ask that us, as we behold your glory on the Mount of Transfiguration, as we behold your glory on the Mount of Calvary, that you would give us the grace to take up our own crosses and follow you. Help us to live in the tension of suffering with you and sharing in your glory. Amen.